Bitcoin education doesn't matter. The product of Bitcoin education does. So what we are doing here is a means to an end. The end is empowerment. The end is agency. The end is sovereignty. The best way to get there, I believe, is via Bitcoin education, via independent, impartial Bitcoin education. Because the second and third order, they're echoing out into the future, are so profound. So the way that the world is now, we don't have power in our own lives. And what that means is we are disincentivized to build, to create, to plan, right? Because the rules of the game are made by somebody else and they could change them on a whim. Not only do we control our money once we understand Bitcoin, if the path we take to understanding our money is also one in which it empowers our mind, then we have so much more influence on our future. Right? The best way to predict the future is to create it. And that's what we're giving people.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 856655, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is John Dennehy, the founder of Mi Premier Bitcoin, aka My First Bitcoin. Since 2001, Mi Premier Bitcoin has taught over 35,000 students in El Salvador about Bitcoin and created open source resources like the 10-week Bitcoin Diploma Program and the Educator's Lesson Plan. Their curriculum has been used in over 20 countries by more than 30 different projects, including independent education projects in Argentina, Canada, Costa Rica, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Honduras, India, Kenya, Nigeria, Peru, South Africa, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Wow. But this is still very much the beginning for them. So if you want to support their incredible efforts, grab the link in the show notes for their Geyser page or go directly to geyser.fund/project/Mi Premier Bitcoin. Mi Premier Bitcoin is a nonprofit, and they also have a commitment to never take any government funding. The only condition of this collaboration that they have with El Salvador is that all materials created are open source and can be freely used by Bitcoin educators around the world. In this conversation, John and I dig into the origin story of Mi Premier Bitcoin and some of his very colorful history, especially with the police, discuss grassroots Bitcoin education and adoption, and how building a better system is more effective than trying to change the current system from within. This was an incredibly inspiring conversation, and I hope it inspires you to go out there and educate others about Bitcoin. And again, if you can donate a few sats, head to their Geyser page via the link in the show notes. These guys really do incredible work. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast, wherever you're listening or watching, and check out my sponsor Bitbox, also in the show notes, or go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use promo code Walker to get 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. You can also grab links to protect yourself from SIM swap attacks using Ifani and Cloaked Wireless. You can choose which one you'd like. I am a one-man show, so when you use my partner links, it genuinely helps me keep this show running. So thank you. And if you're a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media or through the website bitcoinpodcast.net. All right, without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with John Dennehy. John, welcome to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. It's great to have you here. Good to see you again. Not in the flesh this time, but via the old interwebs.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good seeing you again as well.
Are you fully recovered from Nashville? Because I know I needed a couple of deep sleeps, which I did not get right away. Last night I started to kind of become a human again, I think.
Yeah. So I'm on a similar trajectory. So I was exhausted after Nashville. And, you know, we had planned this way in advance without thinking we're going to be exhausted after Nashville. But we had 2 days, like immediately after Nashville, we had a two-day leadership retreat for Mi Premier Bitcoin on a volcano here, which ended with like a big hike. And, you know, and it was like just intense conversation and then also intense physical activity, which was right after Nashville. So yesterday was like my first day off and there was a lot of sleep.
You know, only in El Salvador, is it just very nonchalant for you to say, yeah, we had our leadership retreat on top of a volcano, like as one does, you know, just normal stuff, right?
Do you guys not do that? No.
Yeah. Oh, that's not a normal thing for leadership retreats. You don't have them by active volcanoes. Okay, cool. Yeah. It's been a while since I've been to El Salvador now. The last time was we went twice in 2022. The first time just to visit, and that's where we met Chimbera and got to see some of the awesome stuff that they're doing in El Zante and with Hope House. And then the second time we were like, oh, man, I hope we get to come back soon. And then lo and behold, a couple months later, we were emceeing at Adopting Bitcoin, which is like, wow, this worked out perfectly. But now we haven't been back since. I think we're going back again at the beginning of next year. So yeah. I'm excited about that. It's been too long.
Yeah. And I think you'll notice so many changes from 2022 to when you come back. I noticed the changes and I'm living here, right? Like I'm here every day. Usually it's really hard to see a place change if you're there. It's easier if you're there and you take a break and you come back. But things are happening so quickly here that you could be on the ground and see them too, which is kind of incredible.
It's not something that is typically, like, it's not something we're really used to in the US, let's say, to see the effect of change kind of in real time. It's tends to be more retrospective, it feels like you look back and you're like, oh wow, look how things have changed. Not always for the better, but it's pretty cool. The biggest takeaway for me both times in El Salvador was the energy and the optimism that you feel there from people. It's really palpable, and people are really, to a fault, everyone I talked to was so proud to show you whatever piece of their country they were occupying, you know, to have you experience it. And that's a really profound thing, I think, just to have that like unbridled pride, which hasn't always been the case for El Salvador, obviously. It's more of in recent memory that's been possible.
Yeah, very recent, in fact. I think that is, it's this intangible thing that touches everything else, right? So El Salvador and Bitcoin are such a complex, sometimes confusing, but I think ultimately great couple, because I think they both encapsulate hope, right? They both encapsulate that tomorrow not just can, but will be better than today. And that just echoes to everything else, that touches everything else. I mean, that's why I'm attracted to Bitcoin, right? I'm attracted to Bitcoin because it's the hope that the future could be different from the present. And that is something that is on the ground here in El Salvador, something that you could feel in the air, that people believe that the future will be better than the present. And that, I mean, that's the only way to live, right? Like, I can't imagine anything else.
It's so true. And it just, you notice such a big difference. Like when, you know, I'm from I now live in generally the Chicago area. And it's funny because, you know, whenever you travel somewhere and you say, you know, oh, where are you from? Like, oh, Chicago, USA, you know, and people look at you like, ooh, pretty dangerous there, huh? Like, ooh, that's got to be kind of rough. Like, and I have to imagine that was the case for most Salvadorans for a very, very long time, except to the extreme. I mean, Chicago is actually it's pretty fucking brutal, if we're being honest. Like, it's a bad situation. But El Salvador was a far worse situation. And now it's very much not. Like, I remember the first time going there, even though I knew Bukele had already started these gang crackdowns, people, you know, when we said, oh yeah, we're going to El Salvador, they're like, oh, are you worried? Like, are you, you know, do you think you'll be safe? And we're like, yeah, I think we'll be just fine. Like, they've really changed things drastically. And truly, I mean, I came back and people were like, was it okay? And you're like, well, Yeah, it was fine. There weren't just marauding gangs on the streets like there were, you know, previously. It was quite peaceful. It was quite nice. The food was great. The people were great. The landscape is unbelievable. And it was an incredible experience. And I am very excited to come back and just kind of see how things may have changed in the couple short years since we were last there.
Yeah. So there was this monument to the peace accords, which were signed in 1992, I believe. So the peace accords of the Civil War here. And it was installed by the president that preceded Bukele. So quite recent, right? We're not talking like 1993. We're talking, would have been like 2013, 14, somewhere around there. No, even later, I think. But the term preceding Bukele's first term. And it was in a very prominent location. It was on the side of like a major thoroughfare here in the capital. And they tore it down and turned it into a park. There's, you know, I don't want to get too into the politics here, but there's a... a framing of the Civil War, which this current government adheres to, that the Civil War didn't actually end in 1992, right? That it continued by other means. And that led to the gangs and like that peacetime period that they were celebrating from 1992 was false. Like now is the time to celebrate the peace. And then there's some backstory with the specific monument that it was the president's wife that designed it. So there were some charges of nepotism there, right? Anyway, so it was wrapped up in all these other things. But the point is that this was a prominent monument in the Capitol. And on Monday it was there, on Tuesday it was gone, on Wednesday it was a park. And like that's the speed of things here, right? Like they have monuments in the U.S. That maybe weren't put up, but commemorate, you know, either the Civil War or in the period shortly after. So it matches with that. And that's a debate that goes on for years, decades later, what to do with them. Like here, it's literally from the start of the week to the end of the week, like the reality just shifts, right? Like that is the... When I saw that, I was like, wow, that is quick. That is so quick how fast things are moving here.
It's got to be a pretty exciting place to be at this time. Like, yeah, you know, it's still, El Salvador has a long ways to go because it's starting from quite a deficit. You know, it's needing to pick itself up. But like, I mean, you can't help but feel the contagious hope when you're there, which is cool. You know, it's a neat thing. It's an inspiring thing to see people that are like, hey, things are getting better here. And I know they're getting better because they're getting better for me. They're getting better for everyone I talk to. That goes a very long way. And it's cool to see.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, before we get in too deep, just for folks that don't know you, I'd love to start out with just a simple question, which is just who are you and how did you get here today to be doing something pretty incredible, which is spreading open source Bitcoin education, not just in El Salvador, but now around the world.
Yeah. Good question. And I'll try to, because I know we had talked previously about kind of a more political angle or maybe better phrased a we don't need politics angle. So I'll try to keep that in the thread there, which won't be hard because that's a thread common throughout my adult life. So I'm from New York originally, and I was 19 when September 11th happened, which had just a really profound impact on me in the moment, but just like it was a fork in the road. I didn't really care about the world before that. I didn't really know about the world before that. Like it woke me up. And it woke me up in a way that was very different from how it woke up most people in my surroundings, right? It didn't wake me up like, okay, well, an eye for an eye, let's get some blood, which was the reaction, the dominant reaction at the time, both from the government, but also from the population. My reaction was, holy shit, this is a symptom of something really deep, and let's solve that, right? Let's solve that. There is a lack of understanding. There is a lack of agency. Like, this is not something that happens in a healthy world, in a healthy system. So I was within a few days, me and a few of my classmates at University of Hartford in Connecticut, we formed the People of Tomorrow, which is just an activist group that ended up, I mean, we had a few different things that we were interested in, like media literacy and financial literacy among them, but our main focus quickly became anti-war, just because that was the drumbeat at the time, was like towards war, right? So to counter that. And we were inspired, our mission statement was inspired by the Port Huron Statement by the Students for a Democratic Society, and inspired by student movements from the 60s. And that was that led to a few years of pretty intense protest organizing, a pretty high incidence of arrest. because from even then, right, this is like pre-Bitcoin, obviously, but even then, it always seemed absurd to me to ask permission to show anger from the person at which you are angry, right? Like, is it okay if I dissent? Like, that always seems so absurd to me. So everything that we did was technically illegal, right? Which meant that, yeah. And I was the president of the club, so I was pretty well associated with it. So there were even like preemptive arrests sometimes. It really took the mask off the power of the state, right? And it's like, hey, if you don't follow our rules, then it's going to be uncomfortable for you. And that came to a head for me 2 years later, in 2003, when the war began. Then I did civil disobedience with many other people. We actually like shut down the federal building in Hartford and said government's closed until the war is over, which I just love that phrase. But yeah, so I spent that night in jail, and with other protesters, we were all like in the same wing. And the police kept the lights on, and this was like the war had just started. So there was this rally around the flag thing, and everybody was super patriotic. I mean, patriotic would be the nice way to say it. Everybody was super nationalist. The correction officers kept the lights on all night, brought a boombox in and played the Star Spangled Banner on repeat, so we could be like better Americans or whatever. And I gave up on the United States that night, right? That's the night that I decided I'm going to finish my studies. I was like I was less than a year away from finishing my studies, and I'm going to leave, right? Like, I'm tired of trying to hold back the tide, right? I want to go somewhere where I could push the tide forward rather than try to hold it back. And Latin America was very interesting to me for a number of reasons, but there was an economic collapse in Argentina in 2001, and it seemed from afar. So I studied sociology and media and sociology in undergrad. So I did a lot of reading about social movements, including modern ones, like what was happening in Argentina. And the economy collapsed, and people kind of took charge of their own lives. There were these self-organized neighborhood assemblies that took care of, like, you know, health and security and these basic needs. Workers took over the factories and kept producing, but just without the owners. And, you know, I'm sure there's tons of problematic things that were happening, right? Like, I was probably romanticizing it, being 21 years old. But I was like, cool, Latin America seems like a place where people, not just in theory, but they have effectively a veto power over the status quo. Like, if things get past a certain point, people will stand up and change things, which is something that I've never seen in the US, unfortunately. Like, I saw this, the war wasn't necessarily popular, right? There were a number of things that weren't necessarily popular, but there was this really defeatist attitude of like, well, that's just the way it is, you know? Let's vote for somebody else next time. So I lived in Ecuador. I moved to Ecuador, and I lived there for about 5 years, which is awesome because I happened to arrive in Ecuador at a time of political instability. So I was able to, like, literally participate in a couple of revolutions there. People power movements overthrew the government. You know, like, the president fled in a helicopter because the airport was taken over. And that was amazing at the time, but then just another disappointment because this new power class took over. And after not too much time, the new power class looked a lot like the old power class, right? They said different things. They wore different colors. They had different, like, lapels that they put on their shoulder. But it kind of seemed like, for the average person, like, they might as well have been the same thing. So that was, at the time, inspiring that, like, oh, people could rise up and change things. But in hindsight, disappointed. And maybe go back to that thread, but just to bring it to modern day and Bitcoin. I also got deported in Ecuador and snuck back in and spent like a few years living there illegally with the help of some unsavory individuals, which is a whole different enlightening experience. But yeah, 2013. So actually before that, in 2011, I was back in the US, back in New York, and Occupy Wall Street seemed very exciting. I was involved with that. Spent some nights sleeping in the park, spent some nights sleeping in jail again. Common theme throughout, right? And that was, again, at the time, encouraging, but it just didn't have the right frameworks to resist. I remember this is just a cool story, maybe worth a little tangent, just to think about, like, the game theory and, like, the challenge of really trying to, because I think the ideals of Occupy Wall Street were revolutionary, right? It was to decentralize power. But there's unanticipated challenges. Like, that is so much harder than people think. And one of the things, so again, I'm staying in the park, just like this liberated zone or whatever. And it was great. People were so wonderful. They were so helpful. If you were cold, somebody gave you a jacket, right? If you were hungry, somebody gave you food. We were all in this together. Great spirit. And obviously the police weren't big fans of that, what was happening. So what the police did, so because there was, like, free stuff, basically, for people in need, what the police did, and I don't know how organized this was, like, if this came from the very top or it was just, like, some precincts that thought of this, but they started to pick up vagrants, right? They started to pick up homeless people, drug addicts, like, people that they had picked up for like, petty theft, and drop them off in the park and say, there's free food here, you know, there's, like, shelter here, like, hey, go take advantage of these people, basically, right? And they did, right? That, like, the movement wasn't built to handle that. It was, like, people came that were hungry to the kitchen, so they were fed, they came, but it but it created this disunity within the movement, like within the people who were staying at the camp, like how to handle this. Like, hey, we're all people, let's help everyone. Then other people were like, that's not the point. We're not like, this isn't about social services, right? This is about something bigger. And but it created this discord, which I think was probably the beginning of the end, right? Because there wasn't this thought out framework. But that was a fascinating experience to me, everything in the past informs what we do in the present. But just these unanticipated challenges when you're trying to forge a new path. But anyway, fast forward 2 more years, I'm in England, and I went to grad school in England, and I had found Bitcoin at that point, right, in early 2013. And not intentionally, kind of a bit of dumb luck, I realized that there was an arbitrage opportunity between US dollars for Bitcoin and British pounds for Bitcoin. I exploited that, and I would buy Bitcoin in again, there was just no infrastructure for Bitcoin in the UK. Like, there literally weren't Bitcoin exchanges in the UK at the time. So I was able to buy Bitcoin in the US and sell it in the UK, take the pounds, turn them into dollars, send them to the US and recycle it. And like each time, like, I mean, it sounds crazy, but even with fees and everything, each time that pile was, I think, 6 or 7% bigger, right? And I was just recycling the same pile for like every couple of days. It just was 6 or 7% bigger, which was great. For a few reasons. One was it paid for grad school. Two was I got to meet really fascinating people because a lot of this was in person. And three, I also felt, even though I had some selfish interest, I also felt like I was helping Bitcoin, right? I was making it a little bit easier for people to buy Bitcoin in the UK. I sold hundreds of people their first Bitcoin. One of the people wasn't a good person. One of the people was a criminal, like a pretty major one. And he had, this was an in-person meeting. I also had a bank account set up throughout the country so people could make direct, like cash deposits or also transfers from their accounts. And one of these, so this guy had my name and he had my routing number, whatever, my bank account number. So, and it was like a Bernie Madoff type deal. So he sold fake stocks and bonds. I think it was actually one of the biggest securities fraud cases in UK history. And this guy set up a false lead for the police using my information. So he set up a shell corporation in my name with my bank account. So the police actually, so major crimes, like 30 police officers descended on my house and to arrest me. I happened to not be home at the time and I never went back to England after that. I shut down like the business and everything worked out in the end. I was able to explain to them what happened. I was able to show them the chat logs and show them like the transaction history, because this is all on chain, right? So I was able to show them the transaction history, which also required me explaining what Bitcoin is to these people, right? Which was like
surreal. God, that's kind of, this was 2013 still?
Yeah. This might have been 2014 when the police got involved.
Did they end up getting the guy, the Bernie Madoff-esque character? Like, did they end up tracking him down?
I don't know. So I went back to England in 2019. So I wrote a book and I had like a small book tour there, and I needed permission to go back. So I got in touch with the lead investigator from 2014. And it's like, hey, can I come back? Is everything okay? And he wasn't on the case anymore. So he didn't really know. He had passed off the case. But I think him passing off the case meant that it wasn't a positive sign that they were gonna catch the person.
So this guy was good. He was very good then.
Well, yeah.
Good in terms of how he obfuscated his movements, not maybe so good in terms of the things he was doing, but yeah.
He was just so far ahead of the police. Like, he set up this very clear lead to me, and it took the police 6 months to knock on my door, right? So, I don't know, he probably set up other leads for them to follow, right? Like, how many resources did they waste? Like, dozens of police officers, right? Many, many hours of interviews and interrogations with me. So I was like, I don't think they're going to catch this guy. Like, he's just so far ahead of them. But the police officer in 2019, who was the lead initially, when I reached out to him, he told me that he had bought Bitcoin in 2014 because of the case and was retiring early and was like so thankful to have been orange-pilled in 2014. So he like went above and beyond, like, you know, I'm going to check Interpol, see if there's any notices there and this and that. Here's my cell number. Like, call me if anything happens. And so that was cool. But an important part of like lesson from that particular incident, or not a lesson, it scared me. It scared me. I was attracted to Bitcoin because I saw it as anarchist money, right? The separation of money and state and all that. And I, you know, it was a very gray area. There wasn't, like, I didn't have a money transmitter license to sell Bitcoin, but it also didn't exist, right? So everything was like very gray. But then there was this realization that if things had been a little bit different, had I been home when that happened, and had just that, like, it was so different. Our interactions was a phone call, basically. If our interactions was me like chained to a chair, then like maybe, I don't know, they don't want to listen to the guy talking to them about magic internet money, right? Like, that's just a made up story. He's a criminal. But it felt like it was so close to something very bad that it scared me. And while I remained quite enamored and enthusiastic about Bitcoin and its future potential, it scared me from interacting with it very publicly, or like much at all, really. Until El Salvador said that they were going to use it as legal tender in 2021. That to me was tactic permission to be like, okay, the sandbox is open, right? Try to build something.
That's what I was actually going to ask you. You were not living in El Salvador prior to the legal tender law. You decided to make moves after that.
Yeah. So I was, I mean, this was also the kind of the tail end of the pandemic in 2021, which is like a whole other crazy thing. But, so I had removed to Ecuador at the start of 2021. So I was there in, I believe it was June when the president made the announcement. So I was in Ecuador, and like, as soon as he made the announcement, within a couple of days of him making the announcement, after getting over the shock, right? Like, is there a country that's actually doing this? I was like, well, it's Bitcoin, it's Latin America, which I have an affinity for, and it's this like tactic permission. I wanna see what I could do. I wanna participate. Like, this is a big moment. I wanna see if I could help. So pretty quickly, I had in Ecuador. So during the pandemic, I had some thoughts, you know, long walks in a collapsing world. is when I thought a lot about not only that the world was on the wrong course, but how to put it on the right one. And my conclusion was basically frontline Bitcoin education, right? Bitcoin education that empowers people to think for themselves, have agency in their own lives, because I think that that's what got us on the wrong course, is we're no longer thinking for ourselves. We've lost agency in our own lives, and like independent, impartial Bitcoin education to bring people into the space, but in a way that focuses on empowerment was the solution. And more than that, it probably wasn't going to start in a place like New York. It was going to start in a place that wasn't advantaged by the current system. So I kind of tried some things in Ecuador, but it didn't, there was no traction. It was still the pandemic and there was a lot of in-person emphasis in those first days. But then it seemed like El Salvador is like everything just lines up. So I moved to El Salvador 2 months later. So a couple of weeks before legal tender went into effect. So I sold all my stuff and bought a one-way ticket to El Salvador to arrive there before the law went into effect.
It's, you don't waste any time, do you? You were ready to make moves. I love that. Well, and you know, first of all, you have quite an insane story in terms of what ended up bringing you to this small little country that is the first one to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender and now to be doing what you are now. And I noticed that you've also had quite a few run-ins with the law. There's a common thread there that weaves across it all. But I'd love to know a little bit just, okay, so for those that don't know what Mi Primer Bitcoin is, my first Bitcoin, can you talk a little bit about that? Can you say kind of, okay, so you're in El Salvador, you decide that frontline Bitcoin education and giving people not just the education, but actually, you know, helping people not just telling them what to think, but helping them to think for themselves was what was driving you to go there. And you had this kind of, okay, they're making it legal tender there, so I'm presumably not going to get in trouble for doing this. What was then kind of the impetus for, like, or I should say, when did you then start up the whole Mi Primer Bitcoin curriculum? How did that evolve? And just what was that process like to get that off the ground and kind of get some recognition for it?
Yeah. So I think the most powerful thing about the project, about Mi Primer Bitcoin, is that it can be a proof of concept that we could do things differently. So I met in those first days in El Salvador. It was a really interesting place, right? Like late August, early September 2021 was, it had the air of, I want to say, like that first week at university, where like you don't know what's going to happen, but everybody has this sense that things are going to change. So I met a lot of other people doing, or that had ideas for other initiatives. And almost all of them followed what I'll call a fiat model, in that they prioritized like legal standing and financial standing, meaning, you know, register as an NGO and get lineup sponsors and like get those things done and then you know, get to work. Whereas what we did was we just got to work, right? And we actually didn't even think about the other stuff. It was like, well, we're gonna teach people. So in the first days and weeks, I just, every Salvadorian I met, I asked them what they knew about Bitcoin and if they wanted to help teach others about Bitcoin. So it created a quite an eclectic group in those early days, right? Just like quite random from different sectors of Salvadorian society. But it was just about, like, we weren't perfect at all, right? There was, you know, we started with just an intro class, which you know, in hindsight, if I looked up like what the material was for the first classes, it probably wasn't that good. But that wasn't the point. The point wasn't to be perfect. The point wasn't to be well-funded. The point wasn't to be safe, right? The point was to teach people, to empower them, to start a conversation. And it took us, you know, that first, the first month we had 5 students. So September 2021, we had 5 students total, you know, distributed across 3 classes, I think. And by, that was September, by November, we had 300 students that we were teaching.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was just, I think, like, one of the things that has really given me hope for the future is that we don't necessarily follow those rules and we're able to be successful anyway. So, for example, we are mostly, we have some really, really great grantors and, you know, like OpenSats and HRF and Blocks, and some really great corporate sponsor, which is Paystand. But most of our funding, so 65% of our funding to date has been grassroots. It's just like, wow, individual Bitcoiners who see something that they believe in and will fund it. And like that other chunk of money, so the other 35%, which comes from more traditional sources, it doesn't come in a traditional way. So we're pretty adamant about not compromising our values, which means that, which isn't compatible with most potential sponsors. You know, most potential sponsors want us to shill their product, basically, right? Like, I'm sure there's a nicer way to say that, but that's the reality. That's basically what it comes down to. And it's like, well, no, we're trying to get people to think for themselves. So we never want to think for our students. Even if we like your product, we're not going to, like, maybe we'll say something about it, but that's up to us. Like, your money has no influence on that. And that's not, I got advice from some people that I really respect early on to not do things that way, to, you know, like, you always have to compromise a little bit. There's always a middle ground. And I think we have been successful because we haven't compromised at all. And so we do get a chunk of money from outside of grassroots, but it's like the best people, right? It's people that are like, you know what? We just really like what you're doing. You know, of course, we'll have like follow-up reports and try to be professional about it and be like, this is what your money goes to, right? Like, it's not like...
That part of it's not like a fiat NGO where the money just disappears into a black box and maybe 1% of it maybe gets to some of the people who are loosely associated with who you're supposed to be helping. Like that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Just a quick question. Do you get, so I mean, since a lot of your donations are coming grassroots and from Bitcoiners, are a lot of your donations like on chain or a lot of them through Geyser? Like, where are you guys, where's the biggest funnel?
Yeah. So, a mix. We've done it twice, but it's going to be an annual thing. We have like a charity auction / gala. So people donate, sometimes their time, like this past year, Jack Dorsey, BTC Sessions, and Jeff Booth all donated a phone call. Basically, right? You could auction for, you could bid to have a 30-minute video call with them. Other people donated more tangible things, like, you know, like a miner or things like that. You know, people overbid on what the value is because it's a donation. So that's one thing. We do that once a year in the spring. We have a Geyser campaign. So a lot of it, the project, we're about to, our birthday is 1 week from today. I don't know when this is going to air, but our birthday is August 9th. So we're going to be 3 years old on August 9th, 2024. And between now and then, we're going to launch a campaign on Geyser. So we always have a campaign on Geyser. Like, that is, you could always donate there, but we're going to, you know, new video, new trailer, new copy. It's going to be some rewards, like just kind of a refresh and a big push. And we're hoping to bring up the total, like to break all the records on Geyser, to bring the total to 5 Bitcoin raised there.
Oh.
So we're over 2 now. So it'd be like 2 more plus by the end of the year. And then there's some passive stuff, you know, people just donate. I mean, all the time, right? Like we're hoping to concentrate it this month. But also some people donate direct on our website. It kind of depends. People are familiar with Geyser or not. And we're Bitcoin only. So we only take Bitcoin, right? Again, this isn't recommended, right? What's recommended is make it as easy as possible to donate. So it's like take dollars, take crypto, whatever. But we want to be a proof of concept that we're not trying to exist. We're not trying to be successful in a world in which we disagree. We're trying to bring the future forward by creating a proof of concept about what is possible. And it's that, I think all the people on the team get that. So they're willing to take bigger risks maybe because of it. Like, yes, it seems like not the standard strategy, but okay.
I think that's actually such a beautiful thing though. And to those people who would say, well, you know, you could probably raise more money if you, you know, did this or that. It's like, I mean, to a much lesser extent, it's the same thing with like Bitcoin podcasters such as myself, who are not doing nearly the quality of amazing work that you guys are doing. We're contributing in our own small way, however we can. But if you decide, okay, I'm gonna take sponsorship money from any crypto company, any exchange, you know, the ones who are typically in past cycles have thrown around the most cash, you know, it's like, yeah, you can do that, and you can get a lot more money that way, a lot more fiat, that's for sure. Or you can be selective and try to work with Bitcoin-only companies who share your ethos and who are willing to also pay in Bitcoin, because it's like, you know, nothing changes unless we change it. You know, somebody has to live the ethos that everybody LARPs about, and it's not easy, but it's also so much more rewarding. And I have to imagine in the NGO space, this is something I brought up with Gladstein, is that, you know, an NGO, a nonprofit, I should say, you know, obviously there are many types of NGOs that are of various forms, but one that is actually raising money in Bitcoin and also distributing that Bitcoin in kind, that is in a very transparent organization inherently. And there is so much dark money flowing around the world through these NGOs, like obscene amounts of money. And it's, you know, you start to raise the question, like back to Gladstein, he said, you know, if you're not mining Bitcoin, you're wasting energy. Well, I think if you're not fundraising in Bitcoin, you're probably trying to hide fraud. And maybe that's a little harsh. I'm not saying that every organization that's fundraising in fiat is committing fraud, but I'd be willing to bet that the organizations that fundraise in Bitcoin commit orders of magnitude less fraud than those that fundraise in fiat. Just a little aside there. Like, I think it's such a beautiful model for that, to have transparency at the core of your organization, which should be there anyway, but Bitcoin forces it in a very positive way.
Well, it's proof of work versus proof of stake, right? So it's like Bitcoin is proof of work, and that is, I'm not just talking about mining, right? Like everything. And fiat is proof of stake. It's about how shiny it is, right? It's not about the work that's done. But it's probably worth spending like a minute on the project and what we've accomplished.
Please, yeah.
It's yeah. So we like, it's not just theory, right? It's reality. We have taught since inception ourselves direct here in El Salvador. We've taught over 30,000 students, and we have developed a couple of different courses, right? There's intro, but our flagship, the one that I think we're most associated with at this point, is the Bitcoin Diploma, which is this 10-week workbook that is, I love the subtitle, Financial Education for the Bitcoin Era. So the first, and this is basically our concept for all the material that we create. The first roughly half, in this case, literally half, because the first 5 weeks, is essentially financial literacy. So it's, what is money? How did we get here? And what's the problem with the way that we think of it today? So it's understanding the problem first, and then the second half is Bitcoin, right? So all of everything that we do is focused on bringing new people into space, getting people off of zero. So this workbook is open source, and it is now, I don't even know where to begin. I'll stay here in El Salvador first. So it has been adopted by the Ministry of Education here. So they've taken that as their primary material. They've, you know, changed the cover and probably a few things within it. But that's the base material for their own Bitcoin diploma. And we, along with Bitcoin Beach is helping us with the trainings, are in the process of training 700 public school teachers. It's a little bit strange. We actually teach them the Bitcoin diploma, our Bitcoin diploma, but then they teach the Ministry of Education Bitcoin diploma. Again, they're very similar. It's basically to give them a foundation of Bitcoin knowledge. So we're training 700 public school teachers now in 2024, and that will roll out in an even bigger way in 2025. We're also working with the Little Hodler to develop some materials for younger audiences. So the Bitcoin diploma is basically, I'd say, 13 plus for the age range. And we're developing some materials along with the Little Hodler for younger audiences. So that will, it's about a year behind. So the pilot, when we start to train the teachers, before it expands throughout the country, should be next year. Like this year is just development work. So that's super cool that El Salvador is going to have Bitcoin education at every level of its school system, probably within 2 years, like literally from, you know, first grade until when you finish school. The longer term plan is actually to not make it a separate thing, but incorporate it into existing materials, but I don't know how things are going to change between now and 5 years from now, right? But
I want to pause on that for a second, because that's actually such an incredible thing that it's one of those things that, okay, yes, okay, how nice, you've created this Bitcoin diploma, and how nice you open sourced it, and now the, you know, Ministry of Education, da da da. But like, you zoom out for a second, and then you just look a couple years into the future. You look even, you know, 5 years into the future, and you're going to see massive implications from that. But you look one generation into the future, and that's a complete paradigm shift.
Yeah.
You've educated an entire country from, you know, whatever, pre-K through high school about Bitcoin. And I love that you don't lead with Bitcoin, you lead with financial literacy. You lead with what is broken so that you can show how you fix it. You know, Bitcoin fixes this. But I think it's really hard to, and I'm sure you have clearly thought about this much more than I have, but to even wrap your mind around what the implications of that are in a generation. Because that's, I mean, we're not doing that in American schools right now. They're not doing it in any schools in Europe. They're not, you know, this isn't something that's being done at an institutional level. And I also think that, so I was homeschooled until high school, and having that experience being homeschooled and then going to public school, I have been able to see the stark contrast between teaching children how to think versus teaching children what to think. And teaching children what to think is what our public school system in America does. It is an indoctrination machine. It is meant to check, so you check the right boxes and you walk in a straight line. But your curriculum, as you said from the start, it's about teaching people to have agency, to think for themselves.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So it's much harder is why I think it doesn't happen as much. It's so much easier to tell someone what to think than it is to empower them to think for themselves. It's about time preference, right? It's like what's hard in the present is usually or is often best for the future. What's easy in the present is often worst for the future, right? And like we have this very, our time preference is just off, right? I want to get back to all the accomplishments that
me. Sorry. I think it started making my head spin. Like,
No. I was going to go off on attention on why we do it. Like, Bitcoin education doesn't matter. The product of Bitcoin education does, right? So what we are doing here is a means to an end. The end is empowerment. The end is agency. The end is sovereignty. The best way to get there, I believe, is via Bitcoin education, via independent, impartial Bitcoin education. Because the second and third order effects echoing out into the future are so profound. It's like if you understand, so the way that the world is now, we don't have power in our own lives. And what that means is we are disincentivized to build, to create, to plan, right? Because the rules of the game are made by somebody else and they could change them on a whim. So people are not incentivized to build in that environment, right? And it's subconscious. It's not something that people are actively thinking about, but it's a subconscious effect of the modern world. So in this future world, the step one of which is introductory independent Bitcoin education is one in which we do have agency in our own lives, right? Like we, not only do we control our money once we understand Bitcoin, but if we take if the path we take to understanding our money is also one in which it empowers our mind, then we have so much more influence on our future, right? The best way to predict the future is to create it. And that's what we're giving people. That's the ability to predict their future, because they control their money, they control their mind, they have like more possibilities once they realize that they do have agency. Because we do. It's a false narrative that we can't affect change. We actually can. We're just not taught that. So once people have those two things, control over their money and the ability to dictate their own life, right? That changes everything. And that, one, it makes you a lot more hopeful about the future because you're in control. You're not at the whims of someone else. It also encourages you to build, right? And that could be starting a business. It could be starting a movement. It could be starting a family. It encourages you to create, to plan, to define your own destiny rather than allow someone else to define it for you. And that is like, I'm so motivated and inspired because I personally see so much wrong with the world, and I would probably be pretty depressed if Bitcoin wasn't around by this point, right? But like there's a path, and it's not a sure thing. It's not like, oh, we'll do nothing and we'll just end up in a good place, right? No, we have to be pretty active in this to put us on the right path. And it's an uphill battle. The status quo is pretty entrenched. So it's hard, but it is so worth it. And there's going to be other effects that we can't even conceptualize now, right? Like what's it going to be a generation from now in El Salvador if everyone growing up here has this sort of education, Like, how does that change things? Like, I could guess. But there's probably a bunch of cool stuff that I'm not even anticipating.
The best way to have agency over your own life and your financial future is to hold your own Bitcoin keys, keeping that Bitcoin safe for the long haul. And the best way to do that is to go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then, of course, get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. You may have seen people talking about the Dark Skippy attack lately, which is a way for a malicious signing device to secretly leak your private keys, which is kind of scary. But luckily, Bitbox is one of the only two wallets to actually address this vulnerability, so you're in luck. Plus, the Bitbox O2 is easy as hell to use whether you are brand new to Bitcoin or you are a well-seasoned psychopath. And again, it is fully open source and Bitcoin only. And again, it is Bitcoin only and fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify that for yourself. There is no need to trust me or to trust Bitbox. Plus, when you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you. It's a beautiful thing. And I do want to get back to some more of the accomplishments because I got us off track here. But again, I make no promises about tangents or rants in this show. Yeah. It's a safe space for all. But maybe a good place, because you were going over just some of the things that you guys are doing in El Salvador. And I think with the teachers, with 30,000 plus people educated with this program already, that's huge. But maybe it's a good time to talk about the node network that you call it the node network, right? That you guys have, yes. And how that's expanded. Can you go into that a little bit? Because I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. And just one quick point on El Salvador and beyond is all the work that we do with them is unpaid, right? So we never accept money from this government or any other government, right? Just as a point of principle, because that becomes a slippery slope. We don't want to have that overhang, right? That we owe something. So no government funding, not now, not ever. And yeah, so internationally, so we have a, we're pretty ambitious. We have a vision statement that is three simple steps to change the world. And what I've talked about is step one. So step one is to make an example out of El Salvador, to demonstrate that empowerment-focused, independent Bitcoin education could be a force for good. Step two is to make that example easy to replicate around the world. And that's what the Node Network is. So the Node Network began in March 2023, so about a year and a half ago at this point. And what that is it's Bitcoin educators around the world who agree to a core set of values and use common open source Bitcoin education materials. So the way that we think about it, we're the Genesis node. So we created the consensus rules for the network. And those consensus rules are fairly simple, but very important. And that's that the education must be independent, impartial, community-led, Bitcoin-only, quality, and focus on empowerment, right? So we don't teach people how to get rich. We teach people how to get free. And so long as you agree with those six core values, and you could demonstrate proof of work, right? Like you're actually applying this in your community, then you could apply to the network. And at this point, the network is self-governing. It's we're in the long process of basically spinning it off from me from Red Bitcoin El Salvador. You know, be a part of it, but just be one node in it rather than to dominate it. And yeah, so it's self-governing at this point. So the network itself would then determine whether this was a good applicant or not. And we reject we reject more applicants than we accept. So the network has pretty high standards. But we have currently, we have 25 nodes. No, I'm sorry. We have more than that. We have 34 nodes in 25 countries. So there's a couple of countries with multiple nodes. So it's everywhere. It's actually this map behind me. It's a map of like, I don't know how well you could see it.
But decently well, yeah.
It's one of those scratch-off maps, but instead of the places that that I've been to personally, it's all the countries that have, all the countries are in the case of Canada and the US, states and provinces that have active nodes in the network. Some of them are easy to see, but then there's like, you know, Haiti or in the Caribbean or Georgia in Asia are a little bit hard to see on the map, but they're there.
That's awesome though. And I think the fact that you have that Bitcoin open source ethos, it is so, I mean, central to everything you're doing, right? You're not trying to say, okay, this is Mi Primer Bitcoin and, you know, we're the gatekeepers of this knowledge. You're saying, yeah, we're the creators of this knowledge, but the knowledge is going to evolve and we want it to evolve for different countries because obviously different places have different needs. They've got different things that are going to be relevant for their curriculum that may not be relevant for El Salvador's, for example.
Yeah. And that's a challenge. It's fascinating to be involved with this because there's so much gravity to following established norms, right? And that's an established norm. An established norm is like once you have control over something, you don't give it up, right? Like why would we create a network and then give it away? Like that doesn't make sense, right? That doesn't make sense in the old world. That does make sense in the world that we're trying to create. And again, it's proof of concept for the future. But there's so much gravity that pulls us and pushes us towards trying to fit in to the world we are trying to leave behind, right? And like I see that, I feel it. Like it takes a lot of energy to push against it. I think that's something I didn't realize until this project. I mean, how hard change is, right? It's, you know, revolution is sexy because people think of something that isn't actually revolution, right? They think of like just this, you know, fire and brimstone sort of thing, but that's not. Revolution is much harder than people think and much easier at the same time. It's actually just, it's your everyday decisions. It's not like a grenade. It's what you do every day.
I like that perspective a lot. Just because I agree. People tend to, we're human, right? And turns out humans like romanticizing things. And sometimes that process of romanticizing makes us overcomplicate things as well. And also maybe seems like there is a higher barrier to entry to making change happen than there really is. And I couldn't agree with you more. It's that revolution is the decisions that we make every day. It's the decision that, you know, when you decide to take self-custody of your Bitcoin, that's its own little part of that revolution, right? Of deciding that you are going to increase yourself along that sovereignty spectrum and become more sovereign. It's deciding that you want to educate people and spread the word. Like those are all individual decisions. And then sometimes, like in the case of you guys, a bunch of like-minded individuals can get together and decide that, you know what, we all want to make these decisions individually, but also together. And we can do a lot if we team up and combine our forces. And I think it's incredible to see, because this has been it's a true grassroots movement. I love the pledge not to, I know it's would have been a lot easier for you to probably take money from the government, right? I mean, that's, seems these days everybody loves putting their, you know, hand up, please, sir, may I have some more? Like, but you maintain your principles by not doing so. Not that, who's to say, you know, maybe the government wouldn't have tried to exert any force. But who knows? But it's about the principle of the thing. It's about saying this is not how we're going to operate, and we've made that decision. And so, you know, thank you, but no thank you. But this is a true grassroots movement because of that. And I think that's so powerful at a time where, especially in the United States, and I think you have a very unique perspective on this too, because you come from the United States, but you've spent now many years living outside of the United States. You've seen it from within and from without. And in the United States, as I'm sure you saw at the Bitcoin conference, there is now a lot of focus on that top down, right? A lot of focus on, and which I think it's great. Let me preface this by saying, I think it's fantastic that the Overton window is shifting. I think it's fantastic that because of presidential candidates, because of senators, because of members of Congress speaking positively about Bitcoin, that may make far more individuals decide to wake up and say, oh, I thought this was, you know, Elizabeth Warren told me that this was just for criminals and whatever. But now these other people are saying that it's not. So maybe I should take a look at this. I think that's the really positive thing. It's making people who would otherwise not take a second look at Bitcoin do so. But I think a reliance or an assumption that we need that is, first of all, a false assumption. And second of all, becomes problematic. It goes back to what you were saying about, it's about asking permission from the very people who have created the oppressive system in the first place, or maybe who have not created it, but who perpetuate it. So I'd love, that wasn't really a question, I guess, but yeah. I'd love just kind of your thoughts on that, because this, I mean, you guys are true grassroots, and I think that's beautiful, but that's not easy. But how do you approach that?
I mean, there's a lot there.
Sorry about that.
No, that's a good thing, right? I love, and you could recite it because I don't remember exactly how it is, but you have a phrase or a meme that you've shared a few times.
There is no red, there is no blue, there is the state, and there is you.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. I love that. And just maybe I'll rant a little bit about voting, which I'm not anti voting. I am anti this system, though. And I think that the way that voting is designed ends up entrenching it, right? And so I'm against that. I'm pro delegating decisions to experts if we don't know about particular subjects, right? That we could delegate some of our power to somebody that knows better, which is effectively what we're doing with voting. We're delegating our power to somebody else to make decisions for us. But that's such a blanket, like when we vote for politicians, it's like for everything. Nobody knows your own life better than you do. Some people might know, like if I have some weird growth on my finger, I'm going to go to a doctor. Right. I'm not going to be like, it's up to me. I'm in charge. Right. I'm going to delegate that to somebody else. But the problem with voting is, you know, when we're told that voting is most important, by default, that means all else is less so. And it sends this unconscious message that we can neglect other avenues of change, and it minimizes their appeal, right? So voting takes away, and this is voting for, I'm not talking about like your local councilman, I'm talking about president, something at that level. It takes away your burden of responsibility, right? Like you put your little sticker on, you did your part, it tells you. You voted for someone to make decisions on your behalf. And what that does is it allows us to see injustice in the world and think it's not our role to change it. Or worse, it allows us to become blind to it completely, right? We're pushing that off onto someone else rather than doing it ourselves. And that perpetuates this state that we find ourselves in which we don't have agency in our own lives. And by and large, it's been our choice, right? we are giving that up. That is not the solution. Like, electoral politics are not the solution. The solution is what you do every other day of your life. Like, what you do on election day matters. I'm not going to say, I'm not like, if you vote, you're a bad person, right? Like, go vote. But don't put that much importance on it, right? That's not what really matters. What matters is what you do every other day of your life. And yeah, I think I got off track a little bit there, but it is, we'll never vote our way into an alternative future. When you vote, you're voting twice, once for the candidate and once for the status quo, right? Once for the system that put that candidate there. So if you really want to change the status quo, don't give it power, right? Don't give it legitimacy. Build something better and it will crumble, right? We are given ourselves, we are given the state, we are given the status quo, our power and our agency, and we don't have to. We could build something better. And if we do build something better, if we build a better financial system, if we build a better value system, if we build a better, like the same with proof of work, right? Like, this is happening. This is happening. And I think Me Premier Bitcoin is an example of this, that we don't have to follow these established paths. We could forge new paths. And then the only way you could get on entrench a new path is to get off of the old one, right? So we should collectively, in our own lives, we should just imagine the future world we want to live in and start to act that way in the present. And we should support others that do that, right? Like, I mean, Me Premier Bitcoin has been successful, not because of any single person, but because it's an idea that people can contribute to, right? Whether it's their time, their money, their intelligence. And that's, its success is so powerful because it's creating this new path, right? So I don't know. I think I went off on a little bit of a voting. Hey,
again, safe space for tangents here. As I said, I think just one point I wanted to double back on there was that you're talking about these entrenched systems in the status quo and thinking that it's basically the idea that you're not going to change a system from within a system. Not really. That's kind of this false idea that has been floated that, well, if we just get the right guy or the right gal in there, they'll fix the system from within, because then they'll be an insider in the system and they'll know all the right levers to pull and they'll fix that system from within. It doesn't work like that. No status quo has ever been changed by people who are a part of the status quo. The status quo changes, the system changes, because an outside system, a parallel system, exerts such a powerful force on this entrenched system that it starts to break down, because enough people start moving to this new parallel system. And that's what fundamentally Bitcoin is, right? It's a parallel monetary system. And that's why it is so powerful, because the more people that come over and join this parallel system, the more energy it sucks out of that entrenched system, the less power that system has, the more that system starts to fall apart. And the more it falls apart, the faster it falls apart, the more people jump over to the parallel system. And then it just accelerates. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, 100%. I actually think that Bitcoin in a certain way could be humanity's first real revolution, right? Because it's not changing who is in power. It has the potential to change our relationship with power, right? Which are two different things. It's not okay, instead of red, we're going to put blue. Instead of X, we're going to put Y. Right? Instead of being subservient, we could be self-determined. And that has never happened before. Again, like back to Ecuador, I had a front row seat to a revolution, like literally at the barricades, tear gas, beaten, all that stuff, which was romantic. And it was like what we think of when we think of revolution, right? But it led to something that rhymed with what it replaced, which is, you know, look at history. That's basically how it always is. A true break won't come from within. A true break. So my favorite essay, philosophical essay of all time, is Civil Disobedience by Henry David Thoreau. And he has a great line in there about you lend legitimacy in opposition, right? So to oppose something actually empowers it, to makes it more powerful because it gives legitimacy. If you really want to change a system, you should walk away from it. You should remove yourself from it, right? So in this case, get rid of your dollars, right? Get rid of your euros. Like don't go back and forth. Just move to Bitcoin. The sooner you move to it, the faster that transition can happen. And it's a bit of a leap of faith, right? But a little bit less so with each passing day, I suppose. But, you know, revolution was never supposed to be easy. Change wasn't supposed to be easy. In fact, change has to be difficult, right? There is no such thing. That's like another thing with giving that impression that I'm just like, I hate voting.
I think many of the listeners to this show will feel very sympathetic with your views on voting. So again, safe space here, like a real safe space, not like the bullshit safe spaces, you know?
Yeah. So we have, I'm just reading, this is an article that I wrote in the last election cycle, but we're beaten over our head our entire life with the notion that change begins at the ballot box. That's false. The reality of change is that it's uncomfortable. Voting will never yield substantive change because it is designed to prohibit the very discomfort, which is a necessary prerequisite to substantive change. In the civil rights movement, blacks that sat at a segregated lunch counter did not wait for an election to create change. And that's exactly why they were successful. When we look back, we think of those sit-ins as righteous and assume they were popular. They were not. Forcing change never is. Lunch counter sit-ins were effective because they disrupted business as usual and forced people to look at what many would have preferred to avoid. Change happens when the discomfort of its success is less than the discomfort of our present. That means that the push to create a better future will almost always be unpopular in the present. And the great tragedy of voting is that it tricks us into believing that we could have progress and comfort.
That's really fucking well said. I like that a lot. And I think, again, it's such an important point for people to actually internalize, because neither of us are saying, you know, oh, don't vote or whatever. I always say, you know, do whatever the fuck you want. Like, yeah. I'm never here to tell people what to think, to tell them how to think, or to in any way try to dictate what their action should be. I just hope that people think for themselves at least, and are honest about what the results of their actions really are, and yeah, whether those results, or I should say whether those actions are actually meaningful at affecting the results that they would like to see, versus perpetuating the ones that they are actually trying to get rid of.
Yeah, right. And it's this other concept that this is something else that I love about Bitcoin. So, you know, going back to my own history, in the beginning, then I mostly tried to slow the bad, right? I was like, war is bad. I want to make war harder to start or to continue. And that's wrong. That's the wrong mentality. You shouldn't try to slow the bad. You should try to speed the good, right? And it's the same energy, but one energy is trying to make the Federal Reserve better, like more transparent or whatever, try to make this beast that is before us a little bit less of a beast. Or you take that same energy and you put it into Bitcoin, right? Or some other alternative, but in this example, you put it into Bitcoin and you put that energy into making Bitcoin stronger, easier, more attractive, more resilient, just more adopted. And what ends up happening with the first one, if you try to, you know, blunt the edges of the Federal Reserve, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but who cares? All you've done is blunt the edges. The Federal Reserve is still there. In the other case, if Bitcoin is successful, we don't have to worry about the Federal Reserve. It will just implode. It will collapse. It will become irrelevant, right? And I don't mean to, I'm using this as an example, the Federal Reserve being like a stand-in for the status quo, basically, right? And Bitcoin being a stand-in for an alternative future. Like, I don't think we ever accomplish anything by tearing down. I think we accomplish everything by building up.
It's the idea of, are you running away from something or running towards something?
Yeah. Ultimately. You also feel better. It's like more
right,
fun.
Right. Yeah. And that's why, you know, so many folks who have, you know, been, let's say, like calling for, you know, let me put it this way. I think that so much of the general anxiety and anger and depression and fear that we see in our society today across the world is because people are more aware of the problems now than ever, because we have the internet, because we have real time 24/7, 365, every second of every day news, and we are inundated with it. And typically, algorithmically, if you're, you know, if you're using Nostr, you don't have this much of a problem, but if you're on X or any other, I don't know if folks still use Facebook that much, besides the boomers. That's a different story, but you are algorithmically inundated with things that are meant to make you more afraid, make you more anxious, make you more angry. And when that's what you're bombarded with all the time, when you're always bombarded with the problems and you're never shown a solution, yeah, I can see how you'd be pretty nihilistic. I can see how you'd be pretty down and out about this, feeling like, oh my God, you know, woe is me, woe is the world. There's no way out of this. Look how terrible everything is. It's all I see all the time.
Yeah.
But the problem there is then there's the other side, which is where I think a lot of Bitcoiners have gone, which is, wow, yeah, everything is really fucked up, but there's so much hope. There's so much to hope for. The future is actually going to be brighter. And when you have that thing, that beacon, you know, that bright orange light shining, you can say, oh, well, yeah, everything is really messed up. I'm going to acknowledge that. I'm not going through saying everything's fine. If everything were fine, Bitcoin wouldn't need to exist. But it does exist because things aren't fine. But it's okay that they're not fine because we have a brighter future that we're building toward. And that's, you know, it's one of the reasons I think Bitcoiners talk about Bitcoin so much. It's not most of them, you know, not, I won't make a blanket statement, but most Bitcoiners that I know, that I've spent time with, Bitcoiners like yourself, they're not shilling Bitcoin to try and pump their own bags. Because you random person on the street that I'm talking to about Bitcoin or whatever at a restaurant about Bitcoin, you're not going to pump my bag. You're not going to. And I don't give a shit if you pump my bag. My bag will be pumped regardless. What I do care about is you getting some glimpse of the potential future that we Bitcoiners see, that we see because we're inside this parallel system already, and that people that are already or still in that old system, they can't see. Because they're stuck in that old system. They can't see outside of that system. You have to remove yourself from it before you can see how messed up it is, yes, and the extent to which it is messed up, because it is fucked up. But there's hope. You know, but there is hope. It's gonna be okay.
And I think so. You and I both have a young child, right? We both have children under one. He was crying before. I hope that didn't come across on the audio.
Don't worry about it. This is a family-friendly podcast, except for the amount of times I say fuck. So for any kids listening, I'm sorry.
but that's a small sample size, but let's expand that. So I have about half of my friends are non-Bitcoiners. And half of them are Bitcoiners, right? You know, people I went to high school with and all that, but by and large aren't Bitcoiners. The non-Bitcoin group, the amount of children that those people are having, you know, it's a small sample size, but I'm talking maybe like 50 people on either end of this. And the number of children from that 50 people, I'm making these numbers up, but this is an approximation. It was like 4 kids. And on this side, there's like 20, right? There's a noticeable difference with those non-Bitcoin and Bitcoin, how many children they're bringing into the world. And that, I think that has everything to do with hope, right? Everything to do, again, if not for Bitcoin, I don't know. I don't know how optimistic I would be and be like, well, probably be a bit nihilistic, maybe, right? Which is kind of a trend in the modern world. And I probably wouldn't want to bring a new life into the world, right? So it's this really tangible thing that I don't even think that we are conscious of. It's not like, well, Bitcoin's around, so I should have a kid, right? It's not like this, like in this flow chart. But it changes your mentality. And again, I think that's why Me From Red Bitcoin is so special and revolutionary, because we're not, yes, we are teaching people about Bitcoin. But that's not the point, right? The point is to change how people view their potential future and their own role in that. And that is profound in ways that I don't even think we're capable of understanding, right? But you see it. There's these examples. Why are Bitcoiners having more kids than non-Bitcoiners, right? Like, it's not a very conscious thing. It's a subconscious thing.
The Bitcoin baby boom is very real, which is awesome. Like, I mean, apparently people were really building in the bear market, in more ways than one. And you love to see that, you know, there was hope even in the depths of the bear. I love it though. And I think about my own son, and back to, you were talking about time preference earlier, and that has been such a seismic shift for me. I realized after having my son that my notion of time preference was really more academic, more theoretical. You know, I thought I had a handle on what it meant to have a low time preference, thought I was living that fairly well. And then our son came along, and it's like a light switch flipped on and then was ripped out of the wall, and that light is on forever now. And now I realized that I did not understand time preference before. I realized that me thinking in the long term was, again, academic, theoretical. And now I realize that I'm thinking about, long after I'm dead, what's going to happen. And again, not in this theoretical, like, yes, let me ponder the future. No. Like, I really care about it because my blood is going to be living on after me, after Carl and I are gone. Hopefully that's not for a very long time, you know, knock on wood. But I want that world to be better. Not for me at all, but for my son. And that's a powerful thing. And I did not realize how theoretical my grasp of time preference was until having a son. Yeah. And you can't know. You know, everybody tells you won't know until it happens. And you're like, okay, thanks. You know, great. free advice I didn't ask for. But then you're like, it happens. And you're like, oh shit. Yep, you were all exactly right. I couldn't possibly have understood it. Now I do. You can't unlearn that. Like, it's there now. But that's beautiful.
Yeah. All the cliches are true.
Yes. all the cliches. Well, you know, I want to be conscious of your scarce time and allow you to as well get back to your young child. But I want to make sure, was there anything that we didn't cover about Mi Primer Bitcoin specifically that you wanted to get out there? Because I know we've gone on some tangents. We pulled some different threads. So I just want to make sure if there's anything else, maybe just a place to start would just be, where can people go to support you? What's the best way for them to support you? How can they do that?
Yeah. So on X and other socials, our name is MyFirstBitcoin_. So find us there. Our website is in English, MyFirstBitcoin.io, in Spanish, MiPrimerBitcoin.io. If you are interested in joining the Node Network, then you could find more about that on the website. And that's great. Like if you're interested in educating others in your own community, then this, a core concept is we are more than the sum of our parts, right? Like we actually each individual becomes stronger as the network grows. And we're just starting to see some of those effects now, which is amazing to see that theory become reality. And that's a whole different tangent, but yeah. If you want to support Mi Primer Bitcoin, there's a variety of ways, but we are launching in the next day. So in August, we're launching a fundraising campaign on Geyser. So that's geyser.fund is the website. If you don't know, Geyser is a great resource. It's basically like a crowdfunding platform for Bitcoiners. So support us there. Come to El Salvador. We have a house/school/office. We have open hours there. Come to a graduation. I mean, like we work in public intentionally. So come check out what we're doing in person. And finally, don't wait for anyone else, right? Like we have a lot of tools. Go to our website and we have like open source tools that you could use if you want to get started. But do, don't, whatever. That's not the important thing. The important thing is don't wait for someone to give you permission. You can and should be active in creating your own future in our own future world. I think Bitcoin education is the best way to have an impact there. But just be active. If you are not active, someone else will fill that power vacuum. We all have power that we give to the world, right? And if you're not contributing that, then someone else is doing so on your behalf. So be active in your own life, in your own future. Don't wait for anyone to tell you it's okay.
And that is a fantastic note to end on. I'll link all of this in the show notes as well. So if anyone wants to skip on down to those, grab these links, support Mi Primer Bitcoin, My First Bitcoin. I think it's fantastic what you guys are doing. If you're game for it, I do have one more completely unrelated question to any of this that we've just discussed, but it's one that I like to ask everyone just selfishly. I'm always curious, are you reading anything right now that you'd particularly recommend? If you're not actively reading something right now, is there something that you would always recommend to people?
Okay, I'll go. I just started a new book, but it's probably too early
soon to tell.
To recommend it. I just like, so something that I would always recommend, I'm going to go back to the classics. So Civil Disobedience by Henry David Thoreau. It's quite short. Don't quote me on this, but something like 20 pages or so. And it's been so influential in my own life, but it's also been influential in like the civil rights movement and in the independence movement in India. Like it is a profound document. Like, so yeah, I would recommend that.
I love it. It's a great thing to always recommend a classic for folks, because there's a lot of them out there and I guarantee nobody listening has read them all. So that's a good thing. Well, John, I can't thank you enough for your time here today. This was fascinating. And again, I want to encourage everybody, if you enjoyed this conversation, if it got you inspired, go and, you know, donate a few sats if you have them to Mi Primer Bitcoin. As you heard, they are not taking any money from any ne'er-do-wells or from the state, even if the state may have good intentions with it. So it's a grassroots thing. And grassroots means that it requires people like all of us to chip in a little bit if you like what they're doing. You know, I mean, that's value for value. You guys are putting out value into the world. And I think already we've seen the world give value back. And I hope this next fundraising campaign, I hope it shatters some records on Geyser. I have a feeling it just might.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for your time, man. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin Podcast, consider giving the show a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing the show with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I always appreciate it. You can find me on Nostr by going to primal.net/walker. If you want to follow the Bitcoin Podcast on Twitter, go to @titcoinpodcast and @walkeramerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@walkeramerica and @walkeramerica on Rumble. Or just go to bitcoinpodcast.net/podcast and find links everywhere. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.